Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A columnist for the Los Angeles Times called incivility the new secondhand smoke. Everyone feels impelled to disdain it, but nobody is willing to do away with it entirely. Besides, Tim Rutten wrote, it's profitable. Certainly the South Carolina congressman whose voice rang out, you lie, as President Obama discussed, and I just don't sound as good as he did, discussed his health care proposal before a joint session of Congress, is not the worse for wear. $2 million in campaign contributions have rolled in since he called out the president of the United States on live television. Conversely, his opponent in that race has also been raising a lot of money. I guess it cuts both ways, and that's chicken feed compared to the talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, and satirists Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, who make a ton of money doing what they do, making fun of politicians and sometimes getting very mean. Every election cycle, we complain about negative campaigns, negative campaign ads, and tiresome bickering when there should be genuine debate among presidential candidates. But every election cycle, they get out the vote or keep it at home. And there's more to Glenn Beck than the money he earns for his show. He can also get out the vote, at least in a manner of speaking. Or at least he can convince enough people that the president wants to steal their children's souls to throw hundreds of nation's schools districts into a tizzy. Last week, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood lashed out at the talk show Vitriol and the 24-hour cable news cycle as the shared core of the problem. The week before, the former Ohio GOP chairman Bob Bennett did pretty much the same, asking his state party governing board to speak out against the storm. Bob's in the studio with me today. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Ann.
It's good to be here.
And along with him, Dispatch senior political editor Joe Hallett. Joe.
Nice to see you again, Ann.
You too. And State Representative Ted Celeste, who since 2004 has worked on a project to teach people how to share their opinions in a civil manner, among other things. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, Ann. Thanks very much.
Let's see. Let's listen to radio and TV talk show host Glenn Beck on his radio show talking about President Obama's speech to school children. This is a good way to kick it off.
We have been working now for a couple of weeks on a special one-hour broadcast next Tuesday on television on the indoctrination of your children. And we put it on that Tuesday because of Barack Obama speaking on that Tuesday. Gang, you have a system that is wildly, wildly out of control, and they are capturing your kids. As Van Jones himself has said, the earlier we get the kids, the earlier we make this adjustment with the youth, the easier this transition is going to be. Stand guard, America. Your republic is under attack.
Okay, we're under attack. Bob, wasn't it about that time that you spoke to your party leaders and asked them to do something about this? What happened?
Well, I think that, I've been disturbed for some time about the fact that the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks don't speak for the Republican Party. We have elected leaders that's their responsibility and their job to speak out on the issues. And I just think that there's just too much hate and cancer in the system right now when we draw these lines on the far left or the far right. And and Glenn Beck's a good example here. President Bush, President Reagan, first President Bush, all spoke to school children. In fact, President Bush, George W. was speaking to a classroom in Florida when 9/11 occurred. So
he had personally physically invaded the school.
So I think for us to, in anticipation of a president's talk to children about staying in school, to say that somehow we're indoctrinating children into a political philosophy on either the right or the left is just wrong. Now, I have a lot of problems sometimes with teachers and professors being a little bit too far to the left and not more centrist, but I think there's a way that you can handle that by the people that get involved in teaching at the grade school and right up through high school and college.
You know, Rush Limbaugh's been around for a long time, and he's gained steam over the years. I remember meeting him briefly in 1996 at the Republican National Convention in San Diego. Back then, he had a table. You could actually walk up to him and meet him. And even back then, he wasn't what he is today. It kind of grew gradually. Is that how you feel, that all of a sudden you turned around and it was just a big, hairy mess?
Well, I think today there's so many choices out there for the average person, whether it's in entertainment, whether it's in politics, whether it's in religion. The information is out there, and I think that we have to recognize that these individuals are entertainers. They don't hold a political philosophy. It's what they can draw in, the millions of viewers or the millions of listeners that come in on radio. They're entertaining them, and that's their first job, and that's how they're making a lot of money.
Joe, you've been following and covering politics in Ohio for some 30 years, and you've done it at the national level too. I know that every year you complain about the negativity, and it gets worse and worse as Election Day draws near. What's the difference between a negative campaign ad and the sort of stuff that Glenn Beck does?
Well, there's a lot of dispute over what's negative in campaign ads and what's not. If you're using the negative campaign ad in your campaign, you will call it a comparative ad. We're just showing the other guy's record. But if you're on the receiving end, you call it an attack ad, a negative ad. They're, in my opinion, very few really scurrilous campaign ads. Most of them do draw comparisons, legitimate comparisons, although often distorted, of your opponent's record. But
in their face sometimes.
Yeah, well, yeah. You know, when you get that sort of conduct, then it crosses the line, and we have an Ohio Elections Commission that has no teeth and really can't enforce bad behavior in campaign ads. But, I mean, this rough-and-tumble political atmosphere has been with us forever. I mean, in 1856, a Connecticut senator was actually caned into unconsciousness on the Senate floor, and people like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison used newspapers which had no sense of objectivity to attack their opponents and so forth. So we've had this. I think the thing that really has changed is in recent times is the internet, the instantaneous and the anonymity of political discourse has made it coarser. I see it in my own stories, in my columns. My email address is at the bottom, and invariably I'll get very vicious emails, personally vicious emails from people who have no idea who I am, probably have never met me, but they're anonymous and they're instantaneous, and there's something about those two, that combination, that really can turn people into monsters.
Ted, a few years ago, you vowed to run a positive campaign. It so happens at the time against an opponent who had no intentions of doing the same. What was that like, holding back?
It was not an easy task. As many of the political consultants will tell you, if you are attacked or you have a comparative ad, you have to respond in kind. And I believe that if you're going to have any civil discourse once you're elected, that to be taking somebody down in an ad isn't the way that you accomplish that. So it was not an easy undertaking, but actually I had talked to the chairman of my campaign, Terry Davis, and I said, I want to do this differently. Actually, I asked him if he'd join me in the effort. And I said, I want to do this different. I want it to be all positive. He came back to me and he said, I'll do this if you are really committed to the positive campaign. We'd just undergone an effort at our church called Faith in American
Politics.
And I want
to get to that later,
which
yeah,
was really
absolutely
quite an exciting effort to have a civil discourse. But I did say to Terry when he agreed, I said, Terry, there's going to come a time in the campaign where I'm going to have to call on you. And Bob actually may remember this. I had an ad that was against my character, if you will, and so I wrote a letter to the Republican Party and to others, along with Terry Davis. Meanwhile, having to tell all my cohorts in my caucus that I wanted to stay positive, and that was important. The pressure was heavy to run a negative ad. We didn't do it, and I feel all the better for it.
Can you run an ad that responds to the criticism without having it be a negative ad?
Well, once you start doing that, you're just elevating whatever it was that was discussed. My feeling was I was running against an incumbent, and I felt that I could win by talking about what I wanted to accomplish and not by tearing him down.
It's a strange concept. We'll have to get back to that later. You know, the negative ads, though, we're talking about negative ads, and what we're here to talk about, of course, is uncivil discourse. But the negative ads seem to have sort of stoked the coals for what were happening. And then when the internet comes along and we have the cable television and all the different stations and all that choice, that sort of spawned this much larger issue where people feel – I think the anonymity point is a very good one.
You know, know what else has come up, I think, and that is in this past year with the economy as bad as it has been, a lot of people are nervous and fearful. And I think that fear gets fed on by all of this kind of negative approach. And it just – once it starts growing, those people who are really fearful become more fearful.
I think the other thing is I – and I remember Ted and let me say this, is he ran a good campaign, good positive campaign.
Ted's a Democrat.
A lot of
Bob,
people,
you're Republican, right?
A lot of people, I think, took notice of that on both sides of the aisle. But let me say this. Is I think we have too many consultants in the business that are trying to run political campaigns who are in it for their own profit motives. But at the same time, if they picture a candidate with some money or a caucus with some money, then I think that drives them even more to prove that they have to have a winner in that that win-loss column. You know, they need a winner, and if they had the money, that drives them more than anything else into doing things that they shouldn't be doing.
So they're hired guns. They're not emotionally attached to the candidate. They don't have any vested interest in the candidate's proposed policies and what they want to do if they're elected. They just want to get them elected.
Absolutely.
That's their only job. Joe, that wasn't always the way it was. That changed a lot after the 90s, didn't it?
I don't think so. Okay. I think, you know, obviously we saw one of the most famous TV ads only once, and that was in the 1964 campaign, was it? When Johnson ran against Goldwater and had the little girl with daisies and there's, you know, behind her a nuclear explosion. And that ad against Goldwater, obviously saying if you elect him, this is what's going to happen. Your kids are in danger of nuclear attack. So there have been those kind of ads forever, really, almost since the advent of television. But I think Bob is right. There seems to be a culture, particularly in the political advisor world, that likes to go negative first.
I want to get back to that. Right now we're going to take a short break. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about civility today and what it means to our system of government and our politics. If you would like to join the conversation with Joe Hallett of the Columbus Dispatch, State Representative Ted Celeste, and former state GOP Chairman Bob Bennett, give us a jingle at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. We'll be right back.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. It's your choice with the WOSU FYI e-newsletter. Go to wosu.org/email to sign up today. And you can get more radio and less fundraising. The WOSU Fall Membership Drive begins soon, and you can help reduce the number of days. For every $20,000 we raise before the drive, we'll take one day off of the drive. Visit wosu.org/pledgefree for details. In the weather forecast, clouds in the forecast, slight chance of rain and a high of 58 today. Clouds tonight and a low of 50 degrees. Clouds for Wednesday morning, some sunshine in the afternoon and a high of 63. And then patchy frost overnight Wednesday night with a low around 40 degrees. Currently 53 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you would like to join our conversation on civility and political discourse, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsideswithannfisher. Ted, I've heard people say that they think you're spitting in the wind, that eventually the bad guy will catch up, that the voters will be swayed by negativism, and you'll be out.
I hope that's not the case. I did a positive campaign both as a challenger and as the incumbent, and it's worked both times, and feel pretty positive about the ability to keep doing it.
Is that sort of a freak of nature, Bob? Is there anyone else out there doing what Ted's doing?
No. I think there are other people doing it. I don't think we get all the focuses on the negativities of one campaign or another. But I will say this, that if you look at the demographics of Ted's district, which is highly educated voters, probably if you overlay the census tract, they would probably be some of the most educated voters of any House district in Ohio. So they're going to sort it out so that when you stray off of the path into negativity that is harsh rhetoric and is mean and vitriolic, I think that the voters are going to react against that very quickly. So I think to Ted's credit is he understood his constituency very well.
But just to make a point, I admire Representative Salas for the kind of campaigns he's run, but there is some peril in that. And most political consultants will tell you that it's foolish to leave an attack unresponded to. And so somebody, your opponent, might say something very terrible about you. And if it's unchallenged, then you could have a problem.
And so, particularly if you want to go statewide or to go into a larger district or anything outside of, you're right. I mean, his district is.
The other thing, the side of the coin is that he will have an organization behind him. He may not have to personally respond or his campaign personally respond, but the House Democratic Caucus could respond or the Ohio Democratic Party could respond on his behalf while he can still maintain a positive campaign.
There are – go ahead, Ted.
And I was just going to say that one of the difficulties is you're right. It is a little bit lonely in the process. And there are several people who are candidates or incumbents who've called and asked for advice and been called by either the caucus or others, consultants, to say that's really not the way that you're going to get it done. And it's probably not going to work for everybody, but if – a few of us can start to make a difference this way, I think maybe we have a chance of changing the political discourse.
We were talking earlier about political ads and the mean ones, and they're really old as dirt. You're right, Joe. I mean, they were putting out ads or publishing entire newspapers back at the founding of the country saying horrible things about each other. People that we revere today said horrible things about each other. That's somehow different than what we're going through today when we have Glenn Beck telling us that, the president's the bad guy and he's going to indoctrinate our children.
Here's the difference.
Yes, tell me the difference.
And today, it's instantaneous. It's out on the airwaves or it's over the internet. It's instantaneous. You know, I was just thinking the other day, and Joe might correct me on this. We'll see how his history is. But South Carolina has had a little history of individuals that have been pretty rough in politics. We had Strom Thurmond, who was a former Democrat, who was an outright racist back in the 40s and the 50s. We had another congressman, I think, that engaged in a duel back at the turn of the last century. I mean, South Carolina is kind of known for this rough and tumble politics. But in those days, you might not hear about it for 6 or 7 days, and it was all old news. Today, you'd pick it up instantaneously on talk radio, on TV, on the internet. It would be out there
now. Let's listen to the you lie. President Obama was interrupted by an outburst by Congressman Joe Wilson on the floor of Congress during his speech on health care. Let's listen to that real quick and just get a feel for it.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegal. It's not true.
You know what was interesting about that exchange at that very moment was that the president did respond and said,
sure,
that's not true. He immediately dealt with it and then moved on. But Nancy Pelosi sitting behind him sure didn't. She was given the evil eye over there for a long time. It's one thing to have the airwaves filled with these sorts of things, and I want to get back to that in a little while, but it's another thing when it comes into our Congress, in a joint session of the Congress. You can go to Canada or Great Britain, and it's a whole different story. That's part of their culture. What's going to happen now if they've broken through to do that on national television?
Well, I think that it'll continue to probably get worse before it gets better. But if you talk about Canada and Great Britain parliamentary reform, they debate every session.
Right.
I mean, they have time set aside. And even in those cases, even though you may think it's pretty harsh and everything, pretty much stick to the subject matter and then sit down so that when they leave there, they're pretty friendly.
In other words, they don't start calling each other names.
They don't call each
other
names.
Well,
and in fact, in the British Parliament, there is a prohibition,
yeah,
against calling the Prime Minister or another member a liar. And what we saw here was a total break in decorum in the Congress. And hearteningly, both parties responded rather strongly against Joe Wilson. But there were still rewards at the end. As you mentioned in your opening, he used that to raise $2 million for his campaign. So what is the lesson for his colleagues? You know, okay, endure some embarrassment, but maybe you get enough money out of it to win your reelection campaign.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll happen the next time, but this time was so outrageous that it definitely, $2 million.
Well, and the scary thing is the escalation that Bob mentioned. And I mean, in today's paper, the story about the Facebook presence of a poll on assassinating the president. I mean, in any other day and age, if there were questionnaires, or the Secret Service would be at their door the next day. And here it was on a Facebook page. It's getting dangerous.
It feels dangerous. They didn't make much of it in terms of, you know, outright danger. But when you can say it and feel comfortable saying it, then maybe someday someone will do it.
And I think that the real danger is that we fire up individuals who may be a little emotionally unstable, may be mad at the government. We all get that way sometimes. And you fire them up to the point that they cross over the line. And that's the real danger here. And the other danger, the unspoken danger, is the ability, if we continue on this path, ultimately we become, or the public officials become irrelevant to the process. And if they become irrelevant, that's when we start going down as a nation.
Right, and it makes you wonder, can we get anything done if it's personal?
Well, I think the first step we absolutely need to take toward that end is to change the way we draw legislative districts in the state. We have a winner-take-all process every 10 years, and the party that wins this apportionment board, which we can get into if you want, but it
what does districting have to do with
it? It controls the party that wins the state apportionment board, and we'll have that election this or next year.
Right.
We'll draw the new legislative boundaries. And the party that wins invariably draws them to favor their candidates.
Who has the most seats on the board?
So what they do is they find a majority number of – if the Democrats win, for instance, they will draw a majority district that they can't lose, are their strong suit, and they'll leave a lesser number of districts to the Republicans that they can't lose. And then there are – a small number of actual competitive districts in this whole process. Representative Celeste happens to have one. So what we get then are elections that are won in the primaries, not in the general election, where you have to compete for the middle, for you know, I guess the common sense voters in the middle. And instead, as a result, we have House of Representatives, particularly, and to a lesser degree, a Senate, that is populated with ideologues, either on the left or on the right, and they don't want to compromise. They don't want to work with each other, so the political discourse gets more rancorous, and the ability to get anything done is very difficult.
I don't know how many races went uncontested last time. I don't know how common that is, but it is common to have an opponent in a race in, say, a safe Republican district, to have a Democratic opponent, but that has no chance of winning, and they don't really do anything to fight. So there's not really a primary. Is that what you're talking about, that too? So they just slide right into a general election. They don't have to be accountable to their entire district.
Right. If I'm in a safe Republican district, then I know that if I win the primary, I'm going to win the seat in the Ohio House of Representatives, for example. And the way I win that primary in this Republican district is to run to the right of my opponent. So what we have are, and it's the same way with the Democrats running to the left of their opponents in the safe Democratic district. So what we have are elected representatives, and certainly there are exceptions to this, who are not really representative of their districts.
Well, the interesting thing is that in this past race, the Democrats won the majority in districts that had been designed by the Republicans. So it was really a matter of however they responded, messaging wise and everything else, that they did manage to win with the districts that had been designed by the other party. I'd say just as much of a responsibility is term limits. I mean, I think that one of the things that happens is people are always thinking about where next, and it's problematic. And I think the folks that feel it's important to have term limits are looking back at that decision and saying perhaps this is eliminating good institutional memory, and we need to take another look at that.
What do you think about both those ideas, the districting, redistricting?
Well, first of all, Joe and Ted are both right. And just to address to Joe is we're so good at drawing lines. If you have the pencil and the computers, you are so good at drawing lines, you literally can cherry pick the voters that you want in your district.
Well, the Republican Party benefited for many years.
Well, sure. Yep. And I, along with the former Democrat chairman here, Paul Tipps, have been very outspoken on the fact that we need more competitive districts in order to represent the middle, the vast middle that's in the Ohio electorate. It's not on either ends that may be represented in the legislature. I think the second thing is what Ted says is on term limits is right, but I've never seen a poll where term limits gets less than about 70% of the vote. And I really believe that if we could move it to 12 years, it would be a big help in reestablishing some institutional knowledge in the legislature.
Just to be, you know, as balanced as we can, let's listen to a segment by radio talk show host Stephanie Miller. She has a regular segment on her show called Right Wing World, and here is the intro to that segment.
I know you're man enough to dive into the right-wing sludge that is right-wing world.
Step right up, get your Republican talking points, get your peanut-sized brains, your brain must be this.
He has a deep-seated hatred of white people.
To go on this ride!
All right.
Okay. Then she goes on in that segment, though. It's a regular deal to airing a quote, something someone said, a Republican, usually, and then she goes on to mock it mercilessly. Stephen Colbert, Jon Stewart are well known for their satire, which can be very, very biting. But they don't get the same attention, the same criticism that the right wing demagogues or whatever you want to call them do. Bob, why do you think that is?
Well, I think a little bit of it is you go back to probably the 1990s and the Clinton presidency, where there's just a lot of fodder that was given to the talk radio and the TV pundits on what was happening within the Clinton administration. So I think that started it. And then, you know, in fairness, as I think that George W. Bush, after 9/11, certainly with the war in Iraq and some of the other occurrences during his administration kind of fed it on the left, so that you had the two of them now coming together and butting heads, you might say, on talk radio. The problem is that the I think the liberal media has always been able to get a message out over print media. The Internet, I think they're ahead of maybe some conservatives on the Internet, but it appears that the conservatives have been able to rule the airwaves in television
and
radio.
Which is the ultimate mass media today.
Sure.
We're going to take a break in a second, but I want to take a quick call from Rita. You wanted to talk about that media dissemination.
Yes, actually I did. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. Firstly, our founders specifically set it up so that the president would not have easy access to Congress. That's why these presidential addresses were set up. In England, yes, they have the Prime Minister's Hour, and in Canada they have their dispute hour as well. But we did not want it that way here. We said we don't want quote unquote a royal rule here. Mm-hmm. So here the president has to be invited in to speak. So when he's invited, he's supposed to be given that deference to make his speech. That's what democracy is about. No, yes, you're allowed to disagree with the person's comment. But after this person is given the opportunity to speak.
Okay.
So me, it was just a shame that and an embarrassment that we, who are saying democracy, democracy all over the world, are now in a position to show how shamefully we actually handle democracy. You know, and the fact that it was so widely disseminated over the Internet and there is no fact checking. I mean,
okay.
Once we were able to find out that, you know, Wilson is the same man who attacked Jesse Helms' daughter, we realized that, okay, this man is not just angry. It's the fact that he's a racist.
Okay. Rita, I'm going to cut you off right now. We have to take a short break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're having a civil conversation about uncivil political discourse. Join us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Dan Fonte about writing novels based on his experiences as a former drunk and drug addict. Fonte is the son of John Fonte, whose novels were rediscovered through the efforts of Charles Bukowski. Also, we listen back to our interview about facing death with Unitarian minister Forrest Church. He died Thursday. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins at noon, only 20 minutes away, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get more radio. The WOSU Fall Membership Drive begins soon, and you can help reduce the number of days. For every $20,000 we raise, we'll take one day off of the drive. Visit WOSU.org/pledgefree for details. And remember, you can get access to WOSU anytime at WOSU.org. Listen anywhere in the world by streaming on the web. Hear the latest updates from NPR and WOSU News from the convenience of your computer. Listen online at WOSU.org. In the weather forecast, currently 53 degrees in downtown Columbus. Clouds today with a slight chance of rain and a high of 58 degrees and gusty winds today. Clouds tonight with a low right around 50 degrees. Clouds Wednesday morning and then sunshine in the afternoon and a high of 63. We could see some patchy frost overnight Wednesday night and a low of 40 degrees. And now back to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests today are Bob Bennett, former longtime chairman of the Ohio Republican Party, Joe Hallett, senior editor and columnist for the Columbus Dispatch, and State Representative Ted Celeste, who helped found a program to teach people how to discuss politics and public affairs in a civil manner. Ted, why don't you tell us about that? It happened in 2004?
Back at First Community Church, which is an interesting place because we have folks from all walks. Former Governor Taft used to go there. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court goes there. We all participated in a program called Faith in American Politics. It was really an outgrowth of the 2004 election. And the whole point was, how do we talk about and disagree agreeably? How can we have discussion? And it was all about building community. We had small groups that really were committed to listen and listen carefully and tell the truth. And that was an important part of it. And we learned a lot from each other as part of the process.
It sounds to me like something that the people who are going to go there in the first place are already predisposed to civility.
That's correct.
So how do you apply this program?
Well, that is certainly the next step. And one of the things that I did, as a result of an outgrowth of that, and having been successful at my election, was to try to reach out to others to talk about, okay, let's widen the net. Let's see if we can't engage with folks who might not agree with us, even more vigorously disagree, and have that same kind of conversation. It's extremely difficult to engage people that way. And one of the ways that actually was a result of an op-ed piece on civility just a couple weeks ago in the Dispatch, I mentioned that we were having my district dialogue. It was just last night. And some people showed up who were very much in disagreement with the points that I had made there and participated. And I'd say maybe one or two of them who showed up that way will come back, and maybe one or two won't.
Mm-hmm. And, well, Joe, what do you think about that? Is there any hope? Can we teach people how to be civil?
Well, I think Representative Schloss made a very important point early on, and that is there is a tremendous amount of economic angst right now that is fueling the anger. People are so uncertain about almost everything, about their jobs, about their health care, about their pensions. And they're nervous. And when you get that way, you get angry and you look for people to blame. And it's always been easy to blame politicians. So I would hope that when and if we ever come out of our economic tailspin and people start to get jobs again and they become occupied with other matters, that discourse will improve. But I really think that we have a dangerous trend, and believe me, nobody supports free speech more than me, but when we have the AM Dow totally taken over by people who are paid millions of dollars.
Except for WOSU 820.
Well, exactly. Yeah, that's okay. People who are paid millions of dollars to divide us. And on the left, we have the same thing with Keith Olbermann and so forth. You know, George Bush was always wrong in their view. We know that's not true, and we know that Barack Obama is not always wrong.
You know, they don't just aim the vitriol at the candidates, though, or the office holders. It's at each other. These sweeping generalizations about someone, if they support health care reform, they're a communist. These words they're using, Nazism, communism, socialism, because we elected a president by a large enough majority that said he was going to go for health care reform. Bob, what do you make of that?
Well, as I think you have to look at how this is viewed by a lot of people in the business. And this is the game of what I call the gotcha game. If you look at debates today between our major candidates, whether it's for governor, whether it's for president of the United States, what's the thing that everybody wants to do immediately afterwards? They don't concentrate on maybe a message that was given by one candidate or the other about something they wanted to do if they were elected. It's where did they mess up? It's called the gotcha game. You know, did they say something wrong here that's going to come back and haunt their campaign? So as a result, in many of these debates, you have nothing but individuals that are out there trying to avoid making any type of mistake. And I think the American people just tune that out very quickly.
We've got a call from Jeff. He wants to talk about the racial overtones. Jeff, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Ann. Yes, I think it's would be a little disingenuous to gloss over the racial component here, because I'm sorry, I just don't think that any president from Clinton to Bush 1 to Bush 2 or any other president would be so disrespected in so many ways as President Obama is, specifically when Joe Wilson can say something like that and make and other Republicans will actually stand up and defend the him from that criticism. It's just more. It's more than just a lack of civility. It's a lack of respect. That
it's a racial issue.
I agree. I do agree with Maureen Dowd, when she says that today does seem to be a certain amount of pathological inability to accept the fact that there's a black man in the White House.
Okay, Jeff, thanks for your call.
Mm-hmm.
He's right. Yeah. We are kind of glossing over that issue. It's been raised many times.
I don't think it's a racial issue.
Well, maybe not for everybody.
Because there are racists in this country, and we know that. Nobody can deny that. I mean, they were there in the 2008 election. Those people that were going to vote against Barack Obama because he was a black man, and those people who were going to vote for him in the same vein. I thought the president on Letterman the other night handled it very well. He says, look, I was a black man before I was elected. So he's done, I think, more than anybody else to pass this off and not make it a racial issue, because I think that would be very detrimental to the country. Look, we're going through a health care debate in this country that is very similar to the debate that we went through on Social Security long before most of your listeners and myself was even alive. But I remember in the 50s that they were still talking about how bad Social Security was. We're way beyond that now. I think health care is we're in the same position that we were with Social Security back in the 40s and the 50s, whether it's going to be good or bad. But we have government health care right now. It's called Medicare and it's called Medicaid. And you talk to a lot of people that are under Medicare or Medicaid, and they think it's a pretty good program. Not perfect, but they think it's pretty good.
So, in other words, there's not that much to be afraid of. Relax. Let's talk about it.
No, it's afraid of what's coming. I think that's natural. People are comfortable with what they have right now. They understand what their health care coverage is. So the discourse is going to continue there is going to be done by the providers, whether it's the insurance companies, whether it's going to be the doctors, whether it's going to be the hospitals on one hand. Somebody is trying to protect their own turf, and we have to understand that that's what's happening in the debate.
Ted, what about the racial issue?
Well, I was just going to comment, Jeff. I think, you know, you've touched on something that a lot of people feel may be the case. And I think that for some people, it is the issue. But for a lot of people who have kind of joined in the discomfort right now, that's not their issue. They are uncomfortable because they don't have a job, or they're uncomfortable because they're not sure about what's going to happen with the healthcare situation. And so They may feel comfortable with how they feel about their own view of the races, and it's not an issue for them, and they kind of take offense at that. But I think you're right. There probably are a number of people who this is an issue for.
Well, I agree with that. And what really explodes the whole issue into the public view is when a Glenn Beck says something like, Barack Obama hates white people, which he said on his program.
Okay.
I mean, the man does have a white mother, and it was a ridiculous thing to say, but to blatantly put it out there, it just angers those who want to believe it anyway.
Again, the people are already afraid and want somebody to blame.
Gins them up.
Racism's mm-hmm. always been a component in that process. This
sure.
is not new. I mean, I wanted to go to Rod. He's going to bring up a topic that was very troubling. Rod, you're on the air.
Yes. Basically, what I wanted to call in about was you had recently the hanging of a census worker down in Kentucky, and he had the word fed scroll across his chest. And at what point does this incivility begin to cause a breakdown in, government order?
Right. Rod, thanks for calling.
Mm-hmm.
Ted, what do you think?
Boy, that certainly falls in with one of those instances that I had mentioned in the op-ed piece. That it really is worrisome. The anger again on those radio shows about the administration, and trying to make it a populist movement to somehow overthrow a government, a big government, and big government is bad. I think it. There are many, many good things, as the former chairman has pointed out, about what government does for us, and yet. There are those who are saying this is problematic.
You know, but this was horrible. The violence, horrible.
Obviously, it's horrible.
And this is what you were talking about earlier.
I hope it's an isolated incident, but we know that there are groups and individuals in this country that have formed into groups that are anti-government, regardless of what government's in power, whether it's Barack Obama or George Bush, that are anti-government. And I thought that this was a horrible crime, but I thought that it was committed by people that were anti-government more than anti-president or anything like that. And we have these people. We've had them since the birth of the country, and we'll probably continue to have them. And what we have to do is just ferret them out and prosecute them when they commit these crimes and put them away.
I have to say that over time, I have become a little more watchful, a little more careful when I wade into a political rally on the state house lawn or whatever, because people have been ginned up against the so-called mainstream media so much that oftentimes I will, for a story, ask somebody a question and they'll turn on me. And, you know,
what do you mean?
You're part of the problem. You won't tell the truth. Kind of attitude, and sometimes it devolves into real anger. I just say, you know, heaven forbid if there aren't any newspapers around anymore, and we, you know, we rely on talk radio for our information.
Mike, you disagree with what Jeff said about the racial overtones.
Yes.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Okay, first I need to point out, I think it's Bob Bennett, Medicare is what, $47 billion.
Okay, you know what? You know what, Mike? Let's stick to the point.
Okay.
We're getting
okay.
short on time. I want to give everybody a chance.
Well, why is it that people, if a white person disagrees with the performance and policy of a black politician and we speak out against it, we're racist? That's absurd. That's been going on in this community for years with Mike Coleman. There are people that don't like Mike Coleman's performance or behavior. They speak out against it, and they're considered racist.
Well, Mike, what do you think the historical backdrop to that? Why? I mean, do you think it just comes out of thin air, or do you think maybe there's some history there?
There's been no racism used to criticize black politicians. It's people who are black not allowing people, implying that because a white person disagrees with the performance or position of a black person that they're doing it because of race. It's the implication. It's okay. Racism in and of itself.
Oh, yeah, it's a reverse racism. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for calling.
I disagree with Mike, and I'll tell you why. Because I think that the president has gone out of his way to say that the criticism of him is not racial. I think there is criticism out there that's racial in its nature of the president. And I think that sometimes white folks react to blacks that say that everything that comes against them or some individual in the African American community is racial, which is not true.
That they won't take care of the white
institution. So they use that as a kind of a straw man in themselves. So, but I think the president has gone out of his way to say that criticism of him is not based upon race. It's based upon disagreement with policies and everything. And so I would disagree with Mike on his statement there.
What do you think, Joe? What Mike had to say?
I would too. I mean, obviously there are elements of people who are going to see race in almost anything. But I don't think that's the vast majority. I think it's a small minority. And I think people, by and large, are judging President Obama on his policies and on his performance. I don't know. You know, the race card is too often played in campaigns. One of the most despicable examples we saw was in South Carolina in 2000 when John McCain had just won the New Hampshire primary, was on fire, went down there in the Bush campaign, dropped the rumor spread by Falwell and others that McCain had fathered out of wedlock a, you know, an African-American baby, which was totally not true. And Cindy McCain to this day can hardly look at George Bush for that. So those kinds of things, though, that they're the really despicable acts, I think. But I just – there is probably is an element of race in the assessment of Barack Obama, but I don't think that's how majority of Americans, overwhelming majority of Americans, see it.
Otherwise, he wouldn't be where he is today.
Exactly.
Ted, I want to talk more about faith in American politics real quickly. How do you again go back to how do we fix this, and how would something like this? How do you bring people to the table? They did it with the town hall meetings, and by the way, I call them town hall style meetings. They're nothing close to a town hall meeting that I've seen on, you know, mostly in movies, but they don't seem to work anymore. And they're supposed to. That's exactly what they're supposed to do, is bring people together, get all this different sides, give everybody a chance to speak, and they can't even do that.
True. Now, kind of two points I'd like to make. One is the Faith in American Politics itself is an ongoing program at First Community Church, and they've actually put together a package and have it around the country. There are a number of places where it's available. People can get together in small groups.
What's the website, real quick? Can you remember it?
Okay,
we'll post that on the.
You'll probably find it. Probably find it from First Community Church in Grandview.
Okay, or go to WOSU.org and we'll have it posted after the show.
The real commitment there is small groups who are committed to building community. It's a building process, not a tearing down. So I'd also say, in terms of your comment about the town meetings, I've tried to do it differently. Instead of calling it a town meeting, calling it a district dialogue, it is a dialogue. It is as much for people to hear from each other as it is from them to hear from a talking head, from me. And so we actually find that people network. They learn new things about ways that communities have done things. And it's an extremely positive, uplifting effort, I believe.
Hey, do you feel like you've ever changed anybody?
Well, I know that we've actually created some legislation out of the process from the rental foreclosure bill that we passed, because I think you know the story of the individual who had been just gone through a surgery and was unable to move, but given notice she was a renter, and she'd given notice she had to leave immediately and couldn't, and so out of that we developed some legislation. So there was a positive outcome of that. There's also some learning experience from folks who came to our discussions about alternative energy and companies that have matched up, which is pretty exciting.
We're just about out of time. Thanks a lot for being here, Bob Bennett, former state chair of the GOP.
Thank you, Ann.
And Ted Celeste, state representative, a Democrat. And Joe Hallett, senior political editor at the Columbus Dispatch. He writes a column every Sunday, and read it, love it or hate it.
Thanks, Ann.
It's been a pleasure. On All Sides with Ann Fisher today. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.